Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Kathy, for that introduction. And my job today is to do a couple of things. One, to first and foremost, to represent AARP. And this is our first time from our side of the Public Policy Institute to appear at this conference. And you'll find out more about why that is in a second. And I'm getting a thumbs up, so I'm glad that we're welcome. The second thing to do is to really react to some of what you've heard already from our federal panelists, especially from the perspective of older adults. And third, I'll talk to you about a few resources and things that are available out there as well. First thing I like to do is, one thing I always do is to point out that this is why AARP is really interested in a lot of these issues, that we've got a growing older population. You'll see from this slide that this year we have about 40 million 65 and older adults. That's about 13% of the population. By 2030, that number is going to be at 72 million, and by 2050, we're talking 88 million. So we're more than doubling that number of the population, and almost doubling as a percentage as well. And AARP, as an organization, as you most likely know, is focused on the 50 plus. By the way, we have 53 state offices. We have 38 or so million members. But we're really concerned about how these changes affect people as they age. And one thing we typically do is ask people about things that they want. And we often hear, we ask the question, do you want to age in your community or as long as you can? And 89, 90, 91% of people say yes, they'd want to do that. Well, one of the things, we saw the slides from Arlington County, Virginia, I think as an example of this. Well, you have to have the option available to allow you to do that. In the meantime, between now and then, kind of that 11-year gap or whatever you want to say to get from here to there, you've got a lot of people that have to just make do. So whether it's home modifications, you know, to kind of make your home a little bit better for you, or whether it's some of these alternative services, paratransit, what have you, getting a ride from your neighbor or your friend until that runs out. Those are kind of things that people have to do in the meantime to really try to make up for the fact that their communities don't really work for them. So Kathy really mentioned briefly an article that we just did. Again, this was an EPA, HUD, and myself representation. And this is in the current issue of the Public Policy and Aging Report. But we really asked, you know, can the changes to the built environment improve health and well-being for older adults and persons of all ages? That was our question. And you know, the answer is yes. Not to ruin the ending for you. But really, what it needs is a few things. You need housing that works for people, housing in advantageous locations, things that are universally designed and work for a wide range of people, transportation networks that work for people, complete streets, which I'll talk about in a second, street networks that work, some of the things you've heard earlier, affordable transportation options, and a healthier environment, I think, is a third piece as well. And we talked, I heard a lot today about some of the things that can encourage walking and some of those healthy behaviors. Another piece that's really important, especially for older adults, is reducing environmental hazards. That's also a big thing for health. You know, when we talk about heat waves, the big Chicago heat wave in 95, and the people that suffer from that are the most are older adults in these tall buildings that cut off their air conditioning to save money or that didn't have air conditioning. And those are the people that suffer. And so, you know, figuring out ways to make these things work to lower temperatures in urban areas is kind of a side effect of some of these environmental policies, but they can really help older adults as well, especially those that are in need of some of these advantages. So we talked about in the conclusion of that paper, we talk about the way forward. You know, these are some of the elements we really identified as helping older adults. And you saw the web link there, and you can get a copy of that article from the Aging Society's website if you need it to. But one of the big things here is that to accomplish all those things I mentioned, that we need five different parties involved. We need the federal agencies. You heard from them today. You know, I'm representing citizen and advocacy group. But regional organizations, some of the recipients of some of these grants, we heard from some of those folks in the audience, local and state governments as well. But all of these five groups really have to work in concert, that it's not kind of a one-party solution. It's not just waiting for the right kind of grant to come down or the right program to be involved or just to have people show up at the meeting to talk about what they need. It's all of those things together. And that's really the way to have this happen. So that's the sustainable communities effort on the federal level, the metropolitan planning organizations at that regional level and the work there, and some of the state and local issues around planning and zoning, and some of those town hall meetings and all those other things that we heard about from the audience. All those things have to happen together to get us what we want. Now at ARP, we've talked long about livable communities, and we define livable communities as ones that are safe, that have affordable and appropriate housing and transportation options that allow people to facilitate personal independence and lead their best lives. And this is a definition we've long had, and we focus on as really trying to create communities that work, basically communities that let you age. And one of the things that Kathy mentioned, our biennial policy review process, and ARP creates this huge policy book, the phone book of policies, I call it, that talks about the whole wide range of issues that affect older adults. And I write the livable community section, and one thing that we're doing this year is we're really expanding to talk more about health and its interconnection with the rest of these livable communities issues. So we're going to add some things around healthy aging and access to healthy food options and opportunities for walking, connection to health facilities, those kinds of things, and reducing environmental hazards as things that we want out of communities that allow you to age in place if you so choose, or to have the kinds of communities that you want. And what this really does, it's a really kind of a landmark step for us, because it allows us to really talk about these issues in a different way than we have previously, that we're really talking about making sure that all of the sides of a community that affect you are taken into account, the kind of interconnectedness that you may have noticed as a theme through all of these presentations today. Now, the Sustainable Communities Act, the Dodd bill, is the first one that came through the Senate. ARP strongly supports that, just so you know. And it's really, I think, a way to really get in to the federal government, kind of to really make more permanent some of the goals that are looked at through the Sustainable Communities Initiative. So that's something that we've backed as well. And something else that we're big on the federal and local levels are the Complete Streets initiatives. And I like this slide. It's something that appeared in our bulletin for all those 38 million readers. And there's also a report here on Complete Streets that we've done. And take that number down. I'll tell you how to get those reports at the end of this. But you see the graphic here. You'll see a livable community, kind of in our context. You see bike lanes here. You see wide sidewalks with happy people. You see people walking and bicycling. You see a wheelchair user has a respite in the middle of the median to get through. You also see some of the buildings that are right on the street front, so you can get to things you need, space for buses, and of course, space for cars. I mean, this is really what we're talking about here, are getting all of those elements together so that we can have all users reflected. And one of the biggest things for us is to talk about older adults and their needs as part of a wide variety of needs, not just focusing on older adults, but if you make this work for everybody, it works for older adults as well. Now, this report another report that Kathy mentioned, I have one copy here. It's a little heavy to bring a bunch of them, but you can also get this off our website. We also have a summary in the back. But I'm going to quickly tell you an anecdote from this study that we did, and this really I think is important because this really brings home some of the things that were talked about and the things that they're trying to do with this initiative. Like, what's in it, basically, for older adults? So we did this because we were trying to figure out, did the location of housing matter, basically, was the question, specifically in regards to some of the subsidized housing that's out there for older adults. And so we went to, we studied 50 cities, we went, did site visits to a few of those cities, to five of those cities, and we found out a few things that, yes, location matters, but it's not just location. In a second, I'll give you an example of a place that did this successfully, but what I'm not going to show, I don't have time to really go over some of the bad examples of places where even you may have been in a home built near a transit station, but if there's a rickety staircase that's the only way to get to the transit station, or there's crime in the neighborhood, or things are poorly, no sidewalks, that kind of thing, well, then that station becomes useless, and so that proximity doesn't work. That's the 3Ds, those distance development and design 3Ds that were mentioned, really come into play here. Now, a place that did that really well for us in our study was the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I see we had two locations there, but I want to talk more about this downtown location, number two here, which is Nicollet Towers. And you'll see in that upper right-hand corner, that map is of the transit network. So you'll see that the blue lines are buses, and buses that run every 15 minutes all day, basically reliable, good bus service. And those orange lines are light rails. And the circles are quarter and half mile distances from those. And one of those sites we did is Nicollet Towers there. And here's another look at that whole neighborhood. And you'll see Nicollet Towers is here in the bottom right. This is kind of Nicollet Mall, which is a pedestrian mall that was transformed. Nicollet Avenue, and they turn into a pedestrian mall. I'll show you some shots of that later. Over here is a convention center. The theater's here. There's some churches here, some buildings and shops here, and restaurants, that kind of thing. And over at the top, that little circle here, is the light rail station. Right? So, but you can see kind of from the design here, we've got a street network that connects things together that works. And here with these pictures, you'll see here's Nicollet Towers at the top. Here's what the street looks like. Here's a wide sidewalk. You'll see there's not heavy traffic, so this gentleman here can bicycle freely. And if you'll see here, this is the Performing Arts Center's over here on the right-hand side. You can see barely some cafes and some seating areas here, and a very active kind of neighborhood going up there. And so this young lady here is one of the people that we actually talked with, one of the residents of Nicollet Towers. She's 83 years old, and she's one of the few people we talked to there that actually uses that light rail every day. Now, you notice that light rail was about 7 or 8 blocks away, but because the street network worked, because there was places for her to sit, because if she didn't want to walk, she could take the bus and go right up there. She had all those options she needed, so she was able to get to light rail, get to the Mall of America when she wanted to do that. She could get everywhere she needed to go, and she was able to live independently and get out and walk and do all these things on a daily basis. So she's one example, and another example is a woman who didn't even want to live down here, ended up there sort of by accident after her husband's death, kind of decide to be in this place. But then when she was there, she really realized she could get around more. She could do all the same things that Rose did. And so in that one building, out of the three people we talked to, or out of a few people we talked to, at least two of them were 80-plus-year-old women that on a daily basis were out getting all the exercise, getting the places they needed, because this place was well-designed. And it was really one of the better examples from places we talked to. And so kind of our conclusions were basically that we needed a whole range of things to really make this work. And these are things that if the Sustainable Communities Initiative really goes to its end, we can get in more of these communities. When it gets to its end. But you know, but we also need to make sure the communities and the federal government works together, that we get the funding needed. We need, you know, after this administration is over, you know, we've said it's more than 8 years to do anything, no matter what. So you need to make sure that we get kind of these things ingrained into what we're doing. You know, I'm always hedge my bets on the future, but really we're trying to create communities in this right hand side. So we see, we'll start on the left, that you get minimal benefit if people have their own physical limitations that aren't addressed, if things are hard to understand in the transit systems, those kinds of things, if they're poorly planned and economic struggling communities that are unsafe, places like Miami where bus drivers pass. We saw an example of a gentleman sitting on a bus stop there. Well, in Miami, the issue was people were getting passed left and right by buses, especially if you look like you needed to take a long time to board. You might get passed by, and you can imagine at a 90-degree day in Miami, when you wait another hour for the next bus to come by, you know, that's a problem. You know, unreliable service, inaccessible stops, this is the one I mentioned, that kind of thing. Those all create problems, right? But now, through this kind of coordinated effort, you can do things, address some of these impairment issues, you know, not only by living up to just the minimums of the ADA, but really incorporating the needs of everybody into how we plan things, and then really planning safe, healthy, well-designed communities, and really providing transit service that coordinates with that and takes people to all the places they need to go, and really gives people options. And our main policy conclusion, we had a range of them here, but I'm going to focus on this one, which was the integration of housing, transportation, and land use policy in planning and implementation efforts. Now, this report came out right at the same time as the federal initiative got underway. But I'll note that we were writing it a year before that. So I like to think that we were on the ball with this. But what it really says is that we need to integrate these things, and the federal government is taking some baby steps in that direction. But I, for one, really think it needs to go much further than We've got a great start here, but we really need to, over time, get Health and Human Services and those kinds of players involved, because we're talking about spending from one arm of the federal government to another. Well, sometimes housing spending changing can affect our healthcare costs, that kind of thing. And there's no way to really cover that from the federal government standpoint. But you, in your pocket, if you know that adding this feature to your house is going to make you safer and less likely to hurt yourself, you do that. Well, we need to make sure that our federal, state, and regional government entities kind of think that same way. But we have to deal with federal bureaucracy for now. So I'm just happy to see that we've got HUD and EPA together today doing things for us, as well as that effort. So really, to sum up, I think on the reaction part, that the Sustainable Communities effort has been off to a great start. But there's a lot more that's left to be done. I'm very heartened to see that the rural areas are getting some attention in the future. I think that's one area that's really harder to get across some of these benefits to. And that's another area that actually in our new ARP policy, you'll see a more of a focus on that as well. But we really need to make sure that these things are done in ways that work for communities. So now, quickly, I'll go through a few resources that are available for you. We did a toolkit with our friends at housingpolicy.org, and you'll see the web address there. And this is a really user-friendly way to go through a lot of these things that I've talked about today. It summarizes a lot of our reports and some of our other work, so you can feel free to look through that at your convenience. The Public Policy Institute, by the way, it's our 25th anniversary, and I encourage you to go to our website there. You'll see that on the bottom right. Sign up for our mailing list, and we'll keep you informed. But also there, you can find digital copies of any of our publications, and you can email that address to get hard copies. They're free for you to use as you see fit and to share. And in the back of the room there, I have copies of a few things. I have copies of a summary of this report. I have one copy here if anybody wants the full thing. And we have this little in brief summary for everyone else, and you can go ahead and order that. And a packet of things that came that really are some of the documents behind that toolkit. These reports are there in the back view as well, as well as a description of the Public Policy Institute and the work that we do. So really some of these together, there are some resources that you can take back home and maybe make some use out of. So that's my time for now. I wanted to try to get through quickly so we could have some time for questions. But thanks for your time, and I'll, with the rest of the group, I guess we'll take whatever questions you may have.
I'm wondering, it's really terrific that the ARP at the national level is focused on these things. How do we trickle that down to the state level, and what should we do as people that live in our state to make this sort of, because I've brought in the National Refugee Coalition to a series of workshops in Montana, and I think that the ARP people have asked if they want to come, and it's just not quite on their radar.
Yeah, so the one thing, I picked on the federal government for their bureaucracy, but we have ARP has 53 state offices in all the states, the district, and a couple of the territories, and each of those are basically semi-independent, that they choose what their priorities are and what they're going through. Now, the key piece of information, though, is that we are going through a little bit of a reorganization right now through the next 6 months or however long that takes. And during that time is a time when we're reassessing all these priorities and what the issues are going to be. And one of the reasons why we're really focusing on redoing our housing, our livable communities policy as a whole, is that we anticipate that, especially, you may have heard about this thing called healthcare reform, that now that that's not the top priority on the radar for a lot of, it's already been put into place, and there's still implementation and those kinds of things are going on. But a lot more of our state offices will have kind of the opportunity to work on some of these other issues. So the toolkit, some of these other things we put together in anticipation, of that. And so what I would recommend, now I'm pushing from my end, of course, and I would recommend actually going back for any of you in any of the states to contact the ARP state office and let them know that this is important to you, important to the groups you represent for X, Y, and Z reasons. And then there's definitely the opportunity to, amongst those, that whole circle of organizations that's needed to help make change, we can hopefully make the ARP state office in that area one of those keys for you. Sure, in the back.
I'm just building up in Arkansas. No one brag on what AARP is doing in Arkansas. We have a group called Partners in Planning, and AARP participates in this for older adult networks, all the leadership from around the state. And they have been facilitating on livable, sustainable communities for, and they partnered with this, built these things and other, and they built this trailer that you go inside of it and you can see where the universal design bathroom was. And they've worked with the Builders Association in Arkansas to get them certified and how to properly build places. And they're just doing really great stuff. So
yeah.
If you ever want to come to Arkansas and visit them and help us, that'd be great. But ARP's just been a wonderful asset.
And we're really proud of what the Arkansas State Office has done, and there's some work on housing trust funds and some other things that are kind of going on in the state there. And so that's a good example of a state that's really been doing a lot, and our state office has really been active in helping that happen. And part of that came about because some of the local community groups really came together, and you know, our state office folks really saw a place where ARP could plug in and make a difference. You know, we don't necessarily have issue experts at each state, and that's they come up to us at the national level kind of for that, but we really like to have opportunities where we can get in and really, you know, plug a gap, and I think that's really one thing that we're proud of our work there in Arkansas for that. Thanks for that.
Why don't we bring up all the speakers and open it up now for the whole panel? So, Lynn and Abby, we've got this robust panel group here. Does somebody have a question? Yes, Bill?
I'm just wondering, this is a very exciting collaboration, and I'm just wondering if there's a system in place to actually monitor what happens over time. And if so...
What do you mean monitor what happens?
Well, I mean, if you've incorporated some innovation in a particular community, some change. Are you going to monitor that in some way to see how that evolves?
Well, that's a great question, and now you're going to find out even more of your accuracy. The bottom line is, if I could restate your question a little bit, is how do we know if you've been successful?
Yeah. Right?
This is all great to talk about, but how do we know that we're infusing all of this money, we're putting in all of this work, how do we know if we've been successful? So as Abby mentioned, the three agencies have been working together to develop a series of performance metrics. And these performance metrics are geared at the community level. How do we know if we're actually making progress towards a more sustainable community? The issue, of course, going back to the rural piece of it, is performance metrics that may work in New York City, Dayton, Ohio, may not work in Garfield County, Colorado. That the technical capacity and the data availability is going to differ. I just lost my train of thought. It's going to differ dramatically between different types of communities. So we're working now, again, in the three agencies to assess what data is nationally available and how that data could be modified for a Garfield County and a New York City and everything in between. To meet what we're calling these performance metrics, what are some locally available data. So this is a key kind of priority for us probably over the next couple of years. One of the activities that EPA will engage, work very collaboratively with HUD on, is working with a select number of the HUD grant recipients who have a requirement to do the performance metrics so we can sort out that. So that's not exactly answering your question because we're not actually monitoring if there's been some type of innovation. We're thinking, I think, a little bit more systemic. How are we ensuring that there's systemic change? What is a key priority for us is that we can measure kind of apples to apples across the range of communities. For example, that as a nation we are seeing a decrease in vehicle miles traveled. As a nation we are seeing a decrease in per capita impervious surface. As a nation, we are seeing an increase in the number of affordable housing units around transit or for different types of transit options. So what our thinking is each of the communities will be able to report out on that, but there'll just be a higher degree of sophistication, for example, in New York City versus a Garfield. our field counter, there may be a higher degree of accuracy. These are all the issues we're sorting out now.
And quickly on performance measurement, I think the three things that are three issues to think about. One is that the difference between areas, which she touched on. Two is that the long-term nature of these changes kind of can get in the way of any kind of short-term measuring. And three is the fact that, you know, they're representing federal agencies, but when we're talking about the change, there are other actors involved. It's, you know, we can set up the planning and the zoning to work, but you know, first of all, somebody on the city council can kind of push together some project that doesn't work or make sense, or if the private sector, for whatever reason, doesn't do their part, it doesn't necessarily, you know, move as quickly. And so one of the things that's challenging just for us kind of society looking at it is getting past those challenges. And that's, it's a really difficult thing to kind of grasp. I think really another way I'd measure it is by looking at the percentage of people in places that have the kinds of choices that they're, that meet their needs, that kind of thing. Over time and kind of tracking that might be interesting to note as well. But this is a very, it's one of those really complex kind of things to try to get at.
Exactly. And I think this would be a wonderful opportunity to incorporate some, perhaps some health indicators to help define Broadway.
The performance measures are not out publicly yet, but there are public health indicators in there. And just to respond to Rodney, I can tell you, unfortunately, OMB doesn't care that, not to pick on you, that the chair of a planning commission can squash a really good project. They're really looking for results on the ground, kind of moving forward. And this is the kind of bureaucracy of it. So you think, okay, well, fine. What we'll do is we'll send a survey out to everyone who's received federal funds. You're going to get a $5 million grant. You can take 15 minutes to talk, tell us a little bit about what you're doing. But the federal government has a requirement that you cannot ask the same community, the same, more than 10 communities, the same set of questions. You can only
Paperwork
ask
Reduction
communities
Act. Paperwork Reduction Act. Yeah.
So we actually can't do that.
Well, without going through. Right, that's
yeah,
right.
Which we think is important. Anyway, that's too much in the weeds on performance measures, but it's something we talk a lot about when making good progress.
I mean, I'll even just say the two systems, you know, whenever we decided years ago in our infinite non-wisdom to separate environment from health, you know, we've got health departments and environment departments, you know, and also aging is often not in the health department either. They're separate entities. So when we think about that intersection, for years, CDC and EPA have been doing environmental health tracking, and they have different computer systems. They're still trying to get to speak the same language. So for those of us who care about climate change or about air pollution or about extreme heat days, you know, we have the database over here that does all the environmental stuff, and over there is all the health stuff. So it's the nature of the beast. I mean, and I think Dr. Satariano is one of our leaders trying to look at, I think there's the Healthy Aging Research Network at CDC, I have to give credit to, who's really thinking about these metrics, as well as AARP Public Policy Institute, in addition to the rest of us that are the bureaucracy. I know there's other questions. Yes, again.
Suburban development versus a smart growth development, and we have, and our research has shown, and again, it's available on the web, our website. I don't have it here, but our research has shown that it costs about the same to build a smart growth development, for example, as a conventional suburban development when you take into account all of the different costs. And putting out a lot of information about how much money that you can make. It is now backfiring a little bit on us from an EPA perspective, because as we're talking about the stormwater rule and looking at developing kind of gradiated standards so you can direct development and they get a little bit of a pass if you're developing in your urban area, it's already degraded land. Folks came up, well, developers can afford it, they're already making so much money on this. In addition, Smart Growth America and the Urban Land Institute and the National Association of Realtors has created a group called, I want to say Focus or Go Green or something like that, which is specifically geared to do a public education campaign to the developers. Moreover, you go with what the developers read, which is PricewaterhouseCoopers. It's this, they put out a real estate report every single year. And I think since about the early 2000s, what PricewaterhouseCoopers has been telling the real estate market is that the conventional suburban development is not a place to make money. That mixed-use retail, lifestyle centers as a real estate product is where the real investment and real money-making opportunities are.
But I will do a plug for the new Partners for Smart Growth meeting that's going to be in early February, and I had cards that run out long ago. I've been here from February 3rd through the 5th. And the National Realtors Association has been a longtime partner of the new Partners in Smart Growth, so at least there might be some, I don't know, enlightened realtors. I don't know if you want to say more about that, but they clearly have been at the table with planners and public health people and elected officials from county planning organizations that have been
The question is absolutely right. The new part, and I'm a big supporter of the New Partners Conference, but in many ways it's speaking to the converted. And I think that what you're talking about is a real need to kind of get information out more broadly to the developer community. It then becomes an issue of information that you can't share. Because if you're a developer and you're successful at this and making a lot of money, what is in it for you to work with somebody like our group or our partnership to develop a public education campaign to tell other developers how much money you can make? So it really becomes this kind of...
And that's kind of where ARP comes in. I think that one thing that we have is with the National Association of Home Builders, we have the Livable Communities Awards Program. And you can find that on our ARP website. You can search for Livable Communities. But basically, that's a program that's set up for the last few years that actually takes some model developments and examples of things that meet our principles of developments and communities or single homes, and puts them up there as an example kind of for other builders, other NHB members to look at. Two things I've noted is with that is that since the recession, things have gone way down. People aren't seem to do as much, at least much free thinking, or kind of coming up with as many new ideas. They're seeming to be going with what's safer. But second, that's an opportunity, and I think that's a direction that it seems to go over well. That really, by here's some case studies, here's some examples at work. This is what you should be doing. I think we need more of that kind of thing. We've been focusing a lot on most of the examples we get are things that are universally designed, kind of housing that works for all users, and not necessarily at that community level. But I think things like that are a good example, and we need more programs and those kind of things, and it probably have to come from kind of the private sector, the builders themselves. They really react better than when NHB sponsors something than somebody else on.
Ruth.
I have a couple of questions. In Massachusetts last year, we did a housing summit, and it brought together people from architecture, from real estate, from housing units for public housing units, private public housing units, assisted living. And we experienced, Jennifer, the same thing as you did, that the language and the communication, everybody was talking a different language and nobody talked to each other.
Oh, they used the same words but mean different things.
Yes.
Even worse.
So, we're going to put our grant right out. Our follow-up is really, we're trying to figure out how to do some follow-up. But my question to you is that in the aging community, there's a lot of discussion about bringing together housing and services and really thinking about how we can provide in community so that people can age in place, not just the housing that you describe, but also being able to stay in communities. And oftentimes these supports are not, you know, sort of high-tech kinds of things. Their availability of homemaker services and shopping where you can get groceries delivered. But it's those kinds of things. And I'm just wondering if you're thinking about some of those kinds of things and, you know, sort of taking some of the ideas of, you know, some of the Beacon Hill village models. Are you familiar with that?
Well, I'm familiar with NORCs, naturally.
And the NORCs.
And D.C. has Tenleytown. So I don't know. I don't know.
It's like
Hill,
a Beacon
but
Hill.
I do know Tenleytown, and my guess is that it has very similar characteristics.
But it's sort of, you know, really having these services accessible in a different kind of, can you hear me out there? In a different kind of a way so that people can stay in communities sort of emotionally and, you know, health-wise, in addition to the housing and the transportation.
Well, one of the great things about this partnership is the tremendous support from the White House. And what the White House is able to do is to look across all of its funding streams of the different federal agencies. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, the Domestic Policy Council calls us up and says, hey, there's about $700 million that we're giving to, I may get the federal agency wrong, but I think it's Department of Human Health Services, about placement of health clinics in communities. You guys need to talk. So, and we never would have stumbled upon that, for example, had Derek not been looking at, you know, these vast funding streams. And so the idea is to, as you're thinking, what is the criteria that Department of Human Health Services is using to site these clinics? How can we co-locate it in places where we can get other community benefits? So that's kind of like one angle that we're doing. It's not a you know, top, you know, top five priorities issue, but it is certainly something that we're cognizant of moving forward. I would say the vast majority of our work on that very issue is mostly in collaboration with Kathy and her offices as we develop a list of strategies and approaches to put out to communities of what they can consider to implement. For example, we did a technical assistance project in Atlanta, Georgia, working in four communities on how they can begin to develop these communities with the aging population in mind. Kathy, you know much more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I would, yeah, the tech, that was a very good project. But there they were just trying to say, they were people that were all, these are rural suburban with no public transportation whatsoever. And everyone who was 85 now for the next 20 years was planning to still drive their car. And they even had programs of actually just showing people how to use, when they were in Atlanta, the public transit system. But they were going to connect with a bus route that was going to connect all these little surrounding counties every 15 minutes, predictably, to connect them to the resources that they could go to. I mean, there's work at DOT. We couldn't get DOT here. The supportive services that is part of HUD, it's small, it's underfunded, so is Section 202. You know, AARP's study on the places that could flip, you know, that they've done the housing tax credits, we could have an even greater need for affordable housing. So I think it's going to take, and I think Rodney's picture, I'll just go back to Rodney, of all of the partners that are going to need to be there to be, I would say we need the grassroots support, the people who need, you know, okay, I'll let other people go in. But I think we all need to have, many of us, you know, chiming in to say that we need to do these things. It has to be a priority. And it would be when it's recognized at the local area, and they did it through GIS mapping and brought people down to a charrette, brought people in to see how things could be better. And then when all of the county supervisors and the planning commissioners and the people who lived in the community were there, I think this is bringing all the stakeholders to the table. There was now, it's like, oh, this is the easy answer. Of course we have to do these things. Of course we have to put this in place. And instead of saying, oh, this is going to add to my tax bill, it's like, this is going to add to my quality of life.
On the ground level, the development that I spoke about that the Denver Housing Authority is doing, like I had mentioned, they did a huge push to get community input. And so with the development of their elderly facility, they are incorporating pretty much all of the things that you brought up. Access to health care, access to groceries, access to
home care.
Home care. So by, you know, and this was all, you know, I give huge props to the Denver Housing Authority. They took it upon themselves to make sure that they were doing what the community wanted, and that's what they heard loud and clear from their residents. So, you know, it's going to take more grassroots, community level, development based, you know, ideas like that. So.
And I think Ruth's question actually, I think it's an important truth, and this is, you know, something that I hinted at briefly, and that's that we also have kind of a short-term, long-term issue. that in the long term, kind of big picture goal of all the work that they're doing is that we have more communities where all of these things are lined up and meet people's needs. The problem is today is 2010 and they aren't, right? So you don't have a community that meets your needs, so what are you going to do about it? Well, you might start a village initiative with people in your neighborhood. You might try to reach out and give you need paratransit service, all those things we kind of talked about earlier. But one thing that I hope that happens in the future, kind of with the federal efforts and everything else, is that kind of short-term, long-term thing is taken into consideration. We talk about home modifications, and some of those other things are on those documents on the back, which I'm really pushing and hope you take. but really, we do think about kind of those short-term solutions as really getting people in the meantime to figure out to get what they need, but really, we do need these big-picture solutions to really make our communities work better. It's really both. They're not, they're complementary, but one doesn't guarantee the other.
Well, I think our time is up, so I want to give a big round of applause for our very good speakers today, and thank you for being here.